This is Karen Lyle with SalesPort Talk, and I'm here today with Paul Kayard, who is in the class of 2020 for the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame. And this is the first time, Paul, that sailing and a sailor has been included in this Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame. Congratulations on that commendation that the city of San Francisco has given to you.
Well, I'm truly honored as a Bay Area native. I grew up following a lot of the players and athletes that are in the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame. And so to be included is a personal honor, but it's the first time the sport of sailing has been included. And I think it's merited. And so I'm really happy for my sport to also have representation in the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame.
This is a international broadcast that goes out to 168 countries and 82 million people. It's broadcast on the American Forces Network, Stitcher, on TuneIn, on iHeartRadio. I think there's 700 radio stations around the world that carry this. We're talking about San Francisco because San Francisco is one of the first cities to include sailing as a sport, which is really surprising to me. I mean, why hasn't sailing been included? It's an amazing sport. What is it about sailing that you feel merit being put side by side with football, baseball, basketball, tennis, soccer, golf, etc.?
Well, like a lot of sports, we certainly at the professional level, we train just as hard as any other athletes. You know, sailing's been in the Olympics since 1928, so it's one of the oldest sports in the Olympic Games. I've gone to the Olympics twice, and it's really nice to mix with all of the people who have the same dedication, commitment to excellence that the sailors have. You know, San Francisco Bay is one of the epic and iconic places for sailing. And so to have grown up on the Bay was a huge advantage for me in terms of developing my skill set to go and race all over the world as well as all around the world.
You take your life more at risk in many ways because out on the ocean, you've done ocean sailing and also sailing inside the Bay.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the ocean races that you've competed in.
Well, I've raced around the world twice, and I was the first American to win the Whitbread Around the World race in 1998. And that's it's like car racing a little bit. It's a risky occupation. We have had deaths, and we have had boats sink. There's icebergs. There's massive mountainous waves in the Southern Ocean and gales in terms of really strong winds. So, there's a risk in sailing that's probably different than baseball, basketball, and football has some risks of physical injury, obviously. But sailing, you can lose your life in an instant.
And the training is essential.
Of course, the training is essential. There's, you know, different types of training for a race around the world compared to an America's Cup race or an Olympic race. But we are just as committed and dedicated and focused as any other athlete. It's great that the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame has recognized this.
This is Karen Lyle of SalesPort Talk.
All right, thank you for that, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, coast to coast and around the world on American Forces Radio Network. It is Tuesday, and this is when we check in with someone who hosts this segment with me on SalesPortTalk.com. It is Karen Lyle, who's also in her home in the East Bay. How are you, Karen?
I'm doing good. Looking at a beautiful day outside.
And we are joined by maritime historian David Perry now, and I think that's a good name. You, any relation to Commodore Perry, Manila Bay? Because we have the statue at Union Square for all that. Any relation, David?
Well, ahoy. Thank you for asking that. You know, I was raised by my father on Chesapeake Bay on our boats fishing a lot. And my brother is actually named Oliver Hazard Perry for Commodore Perry and his brother Matthew Perry. So when I was growing up, I was always told we were a direct descendant. I've since found out we're not a direct descendant, but my father was a taller of good tall tales. He fully believed in the old adage, never let the truth stand in the way of a good story.
Very good.
That's great, David.
Nonetheless, it led me to a life that has kept me on ships and at sea as much as possible. It certainly did inspire me, so let's leave it at that.
Very good.
David, you were the author of a weekly newsletter on board an ocean liner going around the world in the mid-90s on one of your dream sailing trips. Tell us a little bit about how that came to be.
Well, thank you. You know, that really was a life-changing event for me. I was very proud to be a junior officer aboard Crystal Symphony, a ship I'm proud to say is still sailing, although at the moment, for all the obvious reasons, not with passengers. She's waiting for a time to sail again. And my job was writing the newspaper for the passengers. And so every day I wrote from scratch a newspaper, designed it, put it together. It was, and I mean this in a good way, the hardest, most satisfying work I've ever done. It was pre-internet, so this was good old-fashioned copy and paste and printing and distributing every day to the passengers. So I worked my way around the world, 65 countries, over almost 2 years, almost three circumnavigations of the world. I called it my 2 years before the mast head versus 1 year before the mast.
You know, it always interests me, those luxury liners that have their own, you know, theater and casino and swimming pools and everything. Just two questions. Can you do marriages, and do you do burials at sea?
What a good question. Well, the answer is yes. Every captain aboard ship does have the right to perform marriages. I remember my captain. He was one of the great, truly legendary captains in the industry. Sadly, he died almost 2 years ago, Captain Radolf Malen from Norway, and he did perform marriages. Burials at sea are something that require special permission. I do know that one passenger aboard Crystal Symphony, longtime lecturer, his name's escaping me at the moment, but he was a wonderful, wonderful guy, and he taught aboard ship and gave history lectures, and he loved the ship Crystal Symphony so much that he did receive permission to be buried at sea. I do know that throwing ashes overboard is technically illegal, although I have seen people do it, and I do know that occasionally officers, understanding this is an emotional time, just turn the other way.
Why do you think when you, because I know you study the Titanic and the sister ships, the Olympic and the Britannic, and of course the Britannic ended up sinking, whether it was a torpedo or a mine. But with the Olympic, built basically side by side at Harland and Wolff, and was launched before the Titanic, why didn't that get the same kind of fanfare?
You know, you clearly are an educated guy. You're what I call, when I have my lectures, a rivet counter. You have the history of the three great White Star liners down. You know, over the years, most every major shipbuilding company and ship owner, White Star, Cunard, Norddeutscher Lloyd, they all wanted at one point to have simultaneous launches of great ships. The Bremen and the Europa, for instance, Norddeutscher Lloyd, which preceded World War II and then both served in World War II in various capacities, they wanted to have simultaneous maiden voyages, but that got messed up because there was a fire aboard Europa. The Olympic, when she started her maiden voyage May 31st, 1911, the year before Titanic, she was the big story of the era. The only ship that got more attention during that first decade of the 20th century was the Mauritania and the Lusitania. When the Olympic launched, it was the biggest story. In point of fact, when Titanic launched, it was kind of a meh. This was the second ship. It was almost identical. The Titanic was not full on her maiden voyage, which in retrospect was a good thing because the loss of life would have been even better, worse, I should say. It's only because of history that Titanic has become more famous, sadly. You know, I joke in my lectures that, and of course, then you're right, the third ship, Britannic, which apocryphally many people said was going to be called Gigantic, I've never really believed that story, but she never served as a passenger ship. By the time she was completed, the Great War started, and she became a hospital ship, and on one of her very, very early voyages, repatriating soldiers from Gallipoli, she was sunk off the Greek island of Chios. And you're right, whether it was a mine or a torpedo has never been established. So I always talk about Olympic, whose nickname became the Old Reliable, because, of course, Titanic sank without finishing her first voyage. Britannic sank after less than 10 voyages. And throughout her career, Olympic kept running into everything. She mowed down the lightship outside of New York. She actually, it was later found out, was actually hit by a torpedo that didn't explode, luckily. And she became the only passenger ship ever to run down and sink an enemy submarine. She sank a German submarine. And she kept bumping into things all her life. She rammed the warship Hawk. I always said that the poor Titanic had one bad night and sank right away. The Olympic hit things, everything during her 20-year career, and Keith managed to sailing on.
You've been a great supporter of oceans, David. We last talked at the Ocean Film Festival. I think it was a reception before we had to postpone it, I should say. What's going to happen with that festival? Do you have plans for that next year?
I do. I'm really glad you asked that because, you know, obviously March and April and June are March, April, and May and June in San Francisco and the Bay Area are big months for events, and none of those events are going to take place. The Ocean Film Festival usually takes place in the first week in March, and this year it had an online festival, including a student film festival, but this year it's going to take place in September. We are hopeful that we will be able to gather in person. You know, knock wood, COVID will not come back, or we will be able to keep our social distancing and have a festival in person. So as of right now, knock wood, the 17th annual International Ocean Film Festival will take place in San Francisco, September 23rd through 27th.
A couple more questions for David Perry, maritime historian. Last year I read Dead Wake by Eric Larson, an amazing book. If you think about the RMS Lusitania and being sunk and the U-boat captain, Schwieger, the way he dealt with it, the way the United States reacted to it, then the fact that they thought that they had made it, and there's Ireland right there. It was a beautiful day with calm waters. What is it about these big ships that just speak to you like that?
You know, that's a great question, and you mentioned an incredible book, Dead Wake. I think one of the most important books written about maritime history, but also, frankly, about how wars start, you know, with incidents that become something other than they are. I mean, you know, it was a horrible disaster, a horrible loss of life. I think what fascinates me about ships has, first of all, ever since I was a young boy, I have looked out at the ocean and thought, what's on the other side? And being on the deck of a ship to me is one of the most relaxing experiences on Earth and the most inspiring. And that to me is what continues today. Whether or not you were on the deck of the Old Maury or the Lucy or the Olympic or the Aquitania or the Bremen or the Normandy, the basic feel of what it feels like emotionally and physically to feel the sway of the deck beneath your feet hasn't changed from those great ships of the early 20th century to even if right now you're on one of the mega ships from Royal Caribbean or Carnival. It still feels the same. And that to me is something that I don't think will ever change. I'm a great believer and optimist. There are bookings already into the late fall and early winter, and next year bookings are up for cruise ships. Will it be different for a while? Sure. But the cruise industry will come back safer and better, and I'm looking forward to being back on board.
David, you're a supporter of the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. I saw some photographs after the fire that happened recently. Was she damaged? Is she going to be okay?
She's going to be great. Thank you for asking that. I was awakened early in the morning of that horrible fire. You know, I know Tom Escher of the Red and White Fleet. Luckily, his fleet was safe, but his office was destroyed, including a lot of historic photographs. It's just so sad. The O'Brien had some blistered paint, but was saved by the quick effort of our brave men and women at the San Francisco Fire Department, and especially with our fireboat, the St. Francis. This isn't the first or last time I fear that the St. Francis or the Phoenix will come to our aid. So no, the Jeremiah O'Brien, she's okay. She had a little blistered paint, but my goodness, she was the only ship from the original Normandy D-Day fleet that went back for the 50th anniversary of D-Day under her own power. She's a tough old lady, and I'm glad to say she's still around.
One last question for you. Just back to the Olympic for a second. When you said it's 20-year run, why was a ship that grand scrapped after less than 20 years? Was it obsolete, or was it just unreliable? What was the reason?
Well, you know, there were two ships that went to the breakers around that same time. It was the Olympic and also the Mauritania. There's some very sad shots of the two of them being broken up. Economics, you know, by that time, we had not yet gotten into World War II. I think if they had lasted a little bit longer, they could have served as troop ships and or hospital ships in World War II. You know, ships, they always say, end up one of three places, two places, at the breakers or on the bottom of the ocean. And now the third place, I meant to say, is a Lang being scrapped in India. Ships tend to have a life of 20 to 30 years. There is one ship that has actually lasted over 100. She's been preserved as a hotel in Indonesia. And the longest-serving Cunarder, the Aquitania, of course, was the only ship to serve in both wars, World War I and World War II. Ships don't have that long a life. But, you know, you bring me to a point that I want to get in before I have to go. I'm on the board of the SS United States Conservancy. Easily the greatest ocean liner ever built by the United States and the fastest crossing ever for a passenger ship of the Atlantic. And she's still with us. I touched her hull when I was 10 years old when my dad took me fishing next to her in Newport News. She was moored next to the aircraft carrier Kennedy. And at that point, I knew I was going to have a lifetime love affair with that ship. I'm on the Conservancy Support Committee, the West Coast, one of the West Coast moderators for the Conservancy. And we're having a fundraiser on July 3rd, which is the 63rd anniversary of her maiden voyage, to raise money because she is owned by a nonprofit. She's not going to be scrapped. She's right now in Philadelphia on the Delaware River. And our hope is over the next few years to restore the SS United States into a museum and conference center and have her moored hopefully somewhere in New York Harbor, maybe next to the Intrepid. We do a very good job in this country of preserving our architectural heritage. We do a lousy job of preserving our maritime heritage, I'm afraid to say.
There he is, David Perry, maritime historian. This flew by. Thank you so much, David. Really appreciate your insights and your efforts, and let's catch up again sometime.
I would love it. Anytime. A great pleasure. Ahoy.
Thank you, David.
And Karen, nice job, and we'll see you next week, kiddo.
Okay, we'll see you.
There it is. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back on Sports Byline USA.